From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, it began.
We will hear argument this morning in case number 11398, Department of Health and Human Services versus Florida.
What followed could determine the fate of Obamacare, a once derisive term that the president's reelection website has now embraced, beginning with an I Like Obamacare campaign. Meanwhile, it was the subject of 6 hours of oral arguments over 3 days in the Supreme Court, the most time devoted to a single law in 46 years. 2 years ago, in an interview with Fox's Greta Van Susteren, Harvard Law professor and former Solicitor General Charles Fried said that if people didn't like the Obama health care legislation, repeal it or amend it, but don't ask the courts to do the job for you, because they won't. Van Susteren asked him if it was at all possible he could be wrong.
I suppose I could, but I'll tell you what, I'd be happy to come on this program and eat a hat which I bought in Australia last month made of kangaroo skin. Hey,
Josh Gerstein, who covers the courts for Politico, says that in the last 2 years since the passage of Obamacare, the constitutional argument against it went from a zany fringe idea to a mainstream debate. Josh, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here.
Here's Nancy Pelosi in 2009.
Where specifically does the Constitution grant Congress the authority to enact an individual health insurance mandate?
Are you serious? Yeah. Are you serious?
Why did it seem so unserious?
Congress has been regulating things related to health insurance for decades. We've had Medicare on the books a half a century or so now, and the insurance that most people get through their employers has been heavily regulated by the federal government for decades as well. And so it seemed to the proponents of the health care reform law that it was obvious Congress had the power to require individuals to get insurance.
The proponents, that makes sense. What did the opponents of the bill think about its constitutionality?
There were a lot of arguments presented about why this legislation is a bad idea. The notion that it was going to be too expensive or too unworkable. And it was fairly minor argument raised only very late in the process that maybe the federal government didn't even have the authority to be operating in this area. I think some indication of the fact that Republicans were not too worried about this was that you had several Republican senators negotiating with the Democrats, and they weren't saying, you know, if you drop the individual mandate, I'll sign on.
Okay, but now the challengers may actually be coming within striking distance of knocking out the president's signature legislative achievement. How did it get from the fringe to the mainstream?
It began with a couple of op-ed pieces that were written in the Washington Post and in the Wall Street Journal in the end of 2009 by David Rifkin and Lee Casey, two lawyers who have worked in Republican justice departments. And they argued that there's no authority in the Constitution for this. They eventually got some support from a Georgetown law professor by the name of Randy Barnett, who wrote a paper arguing that the legislation was unconstitutional. What's interesting, though, is he wrote that paper for the Heritage Foundation, along with a couple of other people. Just a couple of decades ago, the idea of the individual mandate was first promoted by the Heritage Foundation.
But surely these two extremely conservative legal scholars and this paper weren't enough to provide media momentum on their own.
Well, you have to remember what the political atmosphere was like towards the end of 2009 and the beginning of 2010. Angry debates in town hall meetings, the rise of the Tea Party movement, and the arguments that were being made by the conservative lawyers really dovetailed with the philosophy of the Tea Party movement that government was too big. And that really injected this argument into the mainstream of political discourse around 2010.
So 2 years ago this month, President Obama signed the bill into law. Immediately, the lawsuits started coming. At the end of 2010, a U.S. district court in Richmond became the first one to rule that the mandate was unconstitutional.
Ultimately, two district courts said that Obamacare was unconstitutional, and it got huge attention. It got front page play in a lot of major newspapers. It was all over cable television. But what many people don't realize is that there were a couple dozen lawsuits filed all over the country. And most of them, in fact, were rejected by judges. But those early decisions saying the law was unconstitutional really grabbed the headlines.
Is this a clear display of the mainstream media's right-wing bias? she says waggishly.
I don't think it's really a matter of right-wing bias in this instance. It reminds me a little bit of the discussion we often have in newsrooms about, you know, plane crashes and how we cover the planes that crash, but not all the ones that land safely. Likewise, when it comes to the courts, if they rule a landmark federal law unconstitutional, that's a huge headline. If a judge says it's not unconstitutional, that's a brief that you tuck into the national section somewhere.
Did the media change the nature of the debate?
On TV and to some extent in print, you end up with a binary display where you have one person saying it's constitutional and another person is saying it's unconstitutional. I think it's possible that the media did make these arguments seem more legitimate and really pull these arguments into the mainstream. Legal reporters would tell you that the vast majority of legal experts and law professors believe that the Obamacare legislation is constitutional. Even conservative thinkers early on said they didn't think this had much of a chance. They thought it was going to fail in the Supreme Court by something like an 8-1 margin. What took place during the oral arguments doesn't look like an 8-1 case. It looks like it could be closer than that. And the big question we're all left with is that because of what the law dictates, or is there something of a self-fulfilling prophecy here?
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Josh Gerstein covers the courts for Politico.
If media coverage has influenced public opinion about the constitutionality of the individual mandate and Obamacare as a whole, we're still left to wonder if public opinion really, you know, matters when it comes to the court. Dahlia Lithwick, who covers legal issues for Slate, says public opinion does matter.
Is that if public opinion was strongly in favor of the Affordable Care Act, I don't think this law would be in question right now. But because public opinion has been so muddled, polls even this week suggest that some people like some parts of the law, but most people don't like all of it. I think it might even embolden the court to take that step of striking it down.
It's been explained to me since I was about 9 years old that the high court, the Supremes, pay no attention to the push and pull of partisan politics. They march into the courtroom in their robes and rule based on their own deliberations and the sanctity of precedent.
The court is well aware of the fact that public approval of the court is the only thing they have. They don't have the purse. They don't have the sword. The only power they have is the public's belief in their integrity. That said, the justices would not be confirmed to these positions were they not extremely political animals. And so you always have the justices toggling back and forth between their political ideology and the need to look as though that doesn't matter to them. That will keep Justice Anthony Kennedy awake between now and the end of June when the ink is dry on the opinion. Kennedy is going to make a decision about whether this is going to be Bush v. Gore Part 2 or pull the mandate, holding their nose all the way and writing it in such a way that the government could never pass anything like this again, but not just smack this down because they don't like it as a policy matter.
I have read so much from court watchers drawing inferences about the justices' tendencies based on the questions they asked in oral arguments. Has history shown that we can divine anything from the questions to predict what their rulings will be?
Because it was 6 hours of argument, because everyone in America was actually listening, I think it really jacked up the theatricality of it. The questions became somewhat more performative and a little bit less substantive as a result. I will say this, you can clearly tell from some justices' questions where their heads are at. So, for instance, when Justice Antonin Scalia says, "What's to stop the government from forcing me to eat broccoli?" you know where his head is at. But the questions are used for all sorts of things. Sometimes they're used for the justices to talk to one another. Don't forget, they haven't discussed the case until oral argument. And more importantly, they use the questions to try to lobby one another. So we saw lots of justices using their question to try to peel off Anthony Kennedy and bring him over to the fold. Lots of questions that were, "Can you please respond to Justice Kennedy's stated concern?"
The government's case got off to a very slow start on Tuesday.
Insurance has become the predominant means of paying for health care in this country. For most Americans, for more than 80% of Americans, the insurance system does provide effective access. Excuse me.
That was Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General. Kind of a rough start, no?
It was not pretty, but I think it's one of the reasons that the court likes to say they're not going to let television and audio out, because this is the kind of thing that then plays on an infinite loop and becomes an item for the Daily Show. It absolutely became the story and overmastered the constitutional story that was actually playing out.
Now, on CNN, Jeffrey Toobin described this and other exchanges as just a train wreck for the Obama administration. Is it possible that that characterization alone will give the court license to do what it otherwise wouldn't, for the very reasons you cited in the beginning, to preserve its reputation with the American people?
The question of whether that would be the basis for a judicial decision, I think not. This is a 2,700-page bill enacted properly by the Congress, signed into law by the president. I don't think this rises or falls with the performance of the oral advocate. Don't forget, in a case like this, they are writing for the history book. Really, it does seem to me and to most court watchers as though after 3 days of very, very, very partisan, and I even want to say soundbitey and bumper stickery arguing in there, the justices now go into conference and they say to themselves, okay, we acted out, everybody got it off their chest, but we are still the Supreme Court. Our job is to make a determination. Does this law fit inside the goalposts that we have set for Congressional Commerce Clause power or not? That's the only question left.
Dahlia, as always, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick covers legal affairs for Slate.com.
Coming up, the media morphed the image of Trayvon Martin. And is National Geographic sullying itself?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The story of Trayvon Martin that began slowly to build national attention last week has reached a full boil and shows no signs of letting up. And probably inevitably, with more time comes more detail. Detail that complicates the story of a young black teenager shot and killed by neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman, who has been protected from prosecution because of Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. Now, Trayvon Martin had been suspended from school 3 times. Zimmerman had been arrested for shoving a cop and for domestic violence. And with each new fact, new waves of speculation, protests, and media bloviating. To help us peer through the fog of this coverage, we decided to turn again to Trymaine Lee, a reporter for the Huffington Post, who's been following the case almost from the beginning, partly from Sanford, the suburb of Orlando, where the event took place. Trymaine, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us what happened in the last week and what it does to the story that you were originally telling.
In the last week, you've seen a number of official leaks from Trayvon Martin's school in Miami. You've seen police leaks. So there seems a concerted effort to try to kind of shade the character of both individuals. I think the difficulty is for some people to digest that these folks are whole people. Trayvon Martin was this smiling, fresh-faced kid. But you throw, you know, some gold caps on his teeth and throw in, you know, possible marijuana usage. For some people, they're unnerved. And I think some people felt maybe duped, like we thought he was really one of us, but now he's something else. And that something else is, for some, maybe a thug.
So you described a series of leaks that have been coming out. It's coming from the police. It's coming from the school. Are these targeted leaks?
Now you have the Department of Justice is looking into this, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Other state officials and agencies are looking into this. The FBI has joined into this investigation. So I think everyone is trying to cover their behinds now. So the lawyers and the family would say that many of these leaks, particularly those that seem to have originated in the police department, is exactly why you need outside agencies to investigate. So in the last week or so, we've seen one leak come from the police department that kind of explains Zimmerman's account of that night where he said says that he turned around to return to his car and that Trayvon Martin appeared out of nowhere and attacked him from behind, punched him in the face, broke his nose, grabbed his head and was smashing it into the sidewalk. And so now we fast forward a day or two and we get the release of this surveillance video from the night of the shooting just a few hours later. And George Zimmerman is seen exiting a police cruiser, not a bandage, not a bruise, no blood, no soiled clothing. And so the one leak counters the previous leak.
We see it covered a little differently on the various cable networks, and the president's weighed in. Have you watched how the punditocracy has been dealing with this story?
It's interesting because in the first three quarters of this, but there seemed to be a general consensus that there could have been some sort of major misstep here, bordering on a miscarriage of justice. But after the president spoke and mentioned that if he had a son, he would likely look like Trayvon, just from the emails that I've received, they've turned very political, very vile, mean, and angry. And if you look at some of the other sites, you have some produced so-called Twitter images from Trayvon Martin with offensive or questionable language. You've seen some photos on some websites that clearly were not Trayvon Martin of kids with their pants hanging off their behinds and middle fingers up. And I've received emails and Obama seems to be a recurring theme. It's clearly taken a different tone.
When you say mean, do you mean racist?
Oh, clearly racist. I mean, I've seen the N-word, and I've been called personally the N-word. The blacks are doing this. You know, you people, you all. It's kind of disappointing because this is changing the focus here, and the focus needs to be on what does justice mean in America, right? How are we dealing with the race and law and justice in America? These are very important questions that as media, we should be shining light on this situation, however it turns out. But now that it's been politicized and racialized, it's changed the whole tone and temperature of this thing.
You're a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. You reported on Katrina for the Times-Picayune. You worked for several years at the New York Times. Then you jumped to the Huffington Post, a liberal website that makes no bones about its political position. So what I want to know is, do you think your work will be done only when there's a trial, only when George Zimmerman is convicted? What do you want out of this now?
You know, this is the liberal media, right? But for me, I approach it the same way I would any newspaper. And I think that the op-ed page is separate from the newsroom. I don't see any ends in sight. As my mother would say, there is no station in life. It's not like once we get to this point, it's finally a wrap. It's over. I would like to see this the beginning of a conversation and for us to be able to take a real serious look at race in America, justice in America. How are these scales of justice tipped and what is weighing them down one way or the other? So at the end of this, I can't say that I want one thing or the other, but I'm certainly interested in seeing where this goes. I wonder if this ultimately is this watershed moment that we all believe it will be and how we'll all be changed. I think we're all going to be a little different after this.
Tremaine, thank you very much.
Oh, as always, thank you for having me.
Tremaine Lee is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post.
When talk periodically turns to zeroing out public television, an argument sometimes offered is that commercial cable offers a wide variety of educational programming on Discovery, the History Channel, and so on. A compelling point, except that those channels, in their quest for audience, have long since turned from education to pulp nonfiction. Such programs as Pawn Stars on History and American Chopper on Discovery are ratings successes, but Nova, they are not. And sometimes what they teach is just plain wrong, such is the case with a pair of new programs, one called American Digger on the testosterone-fueled Spike TV, and the other, Diggers, on Nat Geo, the National Geographic Channel. Both shows follow treasure hunters as they unearth valuable relics with the help of metal detectors. Their techniques appalled archaeologists. Fred Limp, president of the Society for American Archaeology, said the TV diggers behave like looters.
If these activities were carried out on federal lands, what they're doing would be a felony. They're interested in the objects for their financial value, not for what they tell us about America's past.
Both shows prompted you to write to the producers, but you thought that the Spike TV version was a lot more careless and haphazard.
Both of these shows deal with individuals who are using metal detectors to find historic objects. In particular, though, in the Spike TV, that's then followed up by the use of backhoes, explosive devices, and other things to dig up these objects and then to sell them. In the Diggers show, it's a little bit less invasive.
On the other hand, you singled out the Nat Geo Channel show for trading on the prestige and reputation of the National Geographic Society.
Well, to be quite honest, we hold the National Geographic to a higher standard than we do to Spike TV. The Geographic is a wonderful organization with a tremendous history of supporting science and preservation activities. And so, in that sense, we were more concerned. On the other hand, I must say, once we called to their attention this issue, they've responded in a very positive way, and we are working with them now to develop guidelines for responsible metal detecting. Our sense is that they perhaps honestly didn't really understand all of the complex issues and were taken by surprise with the reaction.
Fred, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Fred Limp is president of the Society for American Archaeology. National Geographic Society CEO John Fahey says that, in fact, National Geographic was surprised by the reaction from archaeologists to its show Diggers.
Quite frankly, I think we were all perhaps a little bit naive that this was in fact such a hot topic for archaeologists. After, you know, we've had a chance to talk to many of the organizations and some of the people, we understand why they feel that way, and we are sensitive to that.
Now, it's not just the Diggers. On your channel, Nat Geo Channel, you've got women in prison, you've got adult men in diapers with bottles and pacifiers, high-priced hookers, Nazis. Has Nat Geo, the channel, strayed from the editorial mission of National Geographic, the magazine published by the Society for the last 100 and almost 50 years?
It's unfortunate in a way that the channel cannot successfully reflect exactly what the National Geographic magazine is. I think the audience for each proves to be very different, and to be successful, we will have to have a mix of shows that we think are spot on brand, spot on mission, and there'll be a variety of other shows there that may not appear to be on mission, but are the types of programs that will allow this channel to survive and thrive so that we can do other things in that portfolio that will clearly be much more what one would expect from National Geographic.
Brazilian women in prison subsidizing voyages to the bottom of the sea. The Society is a 501c3 tax-exempt organization. My understanding is the channel is a for-profit joint venture between you and News Corporation.
News Corporation has 70%. We have 30%.
Who makes the editorial calls?
The editorial calls are made really between us, I mean the National Geographic Society, and the management of the channel. So, for instance, the Diggers show, our colleagues, our partners from Fox, had no idea that that show was going to be on the air. They were not involved in any of the discussions. I can understand your point picking out certain of the programs that, quite frankly, we're not very proud of today. Right now, we have new management at the channel. They are in the process of really looking at the entire slate of programming and working very closely, by the way, with the magazine people here. So we're going to try to get a much larger percentage of that entire portfolio to reflect the principles and mission of National Geographic.
One final thing. Do you or the members of the National Geographic Society or the employees in-house, do you have some sort of like luridometer that, you know, once the needle is buried in the red, you just say, no, this is just too far? How do you make those calls?
We do have a standards and practices group that reviews all of the programming in advance, and we have the right to veto shows. We don't want to exercise that right too often. Yeah, there are a lot of people in the society who pay a great deal of attention to this, and we know when a show has clearly gone too far astray from the brand. And that's why we have a new management team in place at the channel, and that's why we're trying to get back closer to the brand. We have programs that have been on our air, Great Migrations, and we have programs that are coming up, Untamed America and so on, that are absolutely terrific. So we're trying to get this right, and you know, we would acknowledge we're not exactly where we'd like to be right now.
Well, John, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
John Fahey is the chairman and CEO of the National Geographic Society. It's not hard to see why Fahey and his colleagues aren't entirely satisfied. Right now, if you watch the Nat Geo channel, you might see Navajo Cops, a show similar to the Fox TV series Cops, but on an Indian reservation. Or you might see something like this show about lesbian love in a Brazilian prison.
Through the bars of her cell, Aline serenades Luzimara for months on end. Aline wants more than just casual dates with Luzimara. She wants a live-in lover.
Nat Geo Channel CEO David Lyle says the National Geographic Society and its magazine have always explored a wide range of topics.
National Geographic, in the 124 years that it's existed, has prided itself on looking at not just natural history, but the world and everything in it. The channel draws on that proud tradition to have a balance of programming that may look at different cultures, different aspects of the world, whether that be from looking at Navajos or what's happening in Brazil.
There's reality, and then there's something called Blue Chip, which I suppose is tracking geese migrations and, you know, Jacques Cousteau in the Galapagos. And then there's the pulpier stuff. What will be the balance on your watch between Blue Chip and reality?
I think Blue Chip is sometimes code meaning very expensive. Some of the programs that we're proudest of have taken 4 or 5 years, things like Untamed Americas or Titanic or Kingdom of the Ocean. Each of those cost a fortune and took a long time to make. We will always have a balance, too, with contemporary storytelling where we go after fascinating characters and a driving narrative so that our viewers can have a look into extraordinary worlds. And then often when you look at these extraordinary worlds, you find that the people in them, whether they be the Amish or gypsies out of New York, they are strangely relatable.
When we spoke to John Fahey, he acknowledged that some of the fare on the National Geographic cable channels really does not correspond with the society's worldview. Were you brought in to fix that, to create more audience? What was your brief?
My brief is to make the best commercial TV channel for National Geographic. Our channel can never be the magazine. It shares many values with the magazines. We want to have authenticity. We want to have balance. But we cannot be the TV version of the magazine. The two mediums of media are different. I certainly and unashamedly want to make it entertaining, but I don't want to have entertainment without substance.
If I am a member of the National Geographic Society and I'm, you know, I'm 104 years old and I've got 14 tons of old magazines in my attic threatening to crush me at any moment, and I tune in, will I feel that the shows are compelling or a betrayal of the high-toned character that I've come to expect from the brand over all these years?
You'll find them fascinating. They'll open your mind to different places, different societies. But the main channel still wants to have an audience that's 25 to 54. That's true. We're in commercial television, so we do look at the demographics. So your 104-year-old enthusiast may be a tiny bit out of our spectrum.
I guess what I'm asking you, and this is a slippery slope question, if you follow the logical trend from geese migration to diggers and to doomsday preppers, can we be very far from American nudists, you know, on the way to bikini explorers? When does Bikini Explorers air on Nat Geo?
I think all our shows need to be authentic. I pride ourselves on the fact that all the things that we cover are happening before the cameras turned up. So I'm not going to stage sensational events. I'm going to record parts of the world as it happens. And I think it can be popular television and entertaining and right in the National Geographic sphere.
David, thank you very much.
Happy to do it, any old time.
David Lyle is CEO of the National Geographic Channel.
Coming up, video games that enrage or depress. You know, fun.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Pew Health Group conducts research to form policies for preventing unnecessary health risks. At PewTrust.org, the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine. Online at PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, a food co-op in Park Slope, a Tony liberal Brooklyn nabe, had an internal debate over whether to boycott products from Israel. Local papers and news channels covered the controversy. This is from the local ABC affiliate.
It's been a contentious, long-running debate. Eyewitness News reporter Carolina Lead is in the co-op in Park Slope. Carolina.
Okay. But the Park Slope food co-op controversy was also covered by journalists at outlets like CNN, The Atlantic, Wire, Time, The Nation, Commentary, The Washington Post, some foreign newspapers. It was maybe the most covered grocery store story ever. The Daily Show even filmed a satirical exposé.
To witness this struggle firsthand, I traveled to this holy place, home to so many different kinds of devoted NPR listeners.
We often hear about liberal bias or conservative bias in the media. There's bad news bias, visual bias, narrative bias, even fairness bias. But this is a story about a members-only food store with a few thousand customers deciding whether to stock a handful of their inventory. So why were the media there in droves? Because they already were there in droves. Like all those summertime stories about Martha's Vineyard, this is a clear-cut case of convenience bias. As The Guardian's Brian Breaker observed while covering the co-op's meeting, it doesn't hurt publicity that 87% of New York's working journalists live in Park Slope. Among that made-up number is Brian himself, whose access to the contentious meeting was assured, as he is also a member of the co-op. When your local grocery store happens to be in a neighborhood filled with ink-stained wretches, a local tiff can suddenly go global. Full disclosure, much as I hate being reduced to a cultural stereotype, I, too, live in the Slope. But I don't belong to the co-op. That's another story. Maybe I can sell it to the Times. Game series Mass Effect has won millions in sales and almost universal critical acclaim, partly because it offers players more choice. Mass Effect lets you decide how to treat the characters you encounter in the game world, and those choices have consequences. The developers at BioWare, the studio behind Mass Effect, went so far as to program their game so that when you pick up a sequel, your character from the previous game is loaded in, ensuring a kind of continuity of consequence that's unheard of in gaming. which led to a conundrum. How do you write an ending that can offer a satisfying conclusion to all the different versions of the story spun out by the players over the past 5 years? What the programmers did was write a narratively ambiguous climax that every player experienced regardless of the choices they made. It was a distinctly Soprano-esque ending which generated Soprano-esque howls of rage. Online petitions circulated. YouTube missives were recorded.
I will not buy another Mass Effect game!
Finally, last week, BioWare Studios announced that its engineers were working on ways to provide, quote, more closure. Tom Bissell writes about video games for Grantland. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back, Brooke.
So you estimate you've sunk about 150 hours into this game series. What's it like to play?
It's a third-person shooter in which you play a character called Shepard. And Shepard can be either a man or a woman. My Shepard is a woman. And so you take Shepard through this pretty massive game world that spans all over the galaxy, and you meet dozens and dozens and dozens of characters and run into dozens of ethical quandaries, some of which don't seem to have any good answer. And of course, the very fate of this fictional galaxy is hanging in the balance throughout it. So it kind of does a lot of things really well that only games can really do. They give you a really pleasing, massive world, and then they give you a lot of agency to determine how that world is going to turn out.
And how'd you feel about the ending?
It was an audacious failure, I would say. It also doesn't make much sense. Now, the cool thing is the possibility that the entire ending is an extended hallucination in the mind of your character, and none of it actually really happens.
Oh, you're kidding me. That the ending was, and it was all a dream?
Yeah, there's a school of thought that actually the ending is much more dreamlike and much stranger than anyone's giving it credit for. Whether or not that makes this bad or worse?
That's a worse cop-out than, you know, and then they were all run over by a truck.
Well, I don't know what to say. I feel like you've got me on a hotter seat than I'd anticipated here.
Your friend Taylor Clark argued in The New Yorker recently against BioWare's promise to address the ending problem. He said that a mature audience for an art form would never call for the artist to actually change a work's ending, that in fact, gamers that do demand a change are essentially childish. Do you agree with that?
I think Taylor was in a somewhat Swiftian mode in that piece. I fundamentally do agree with him that the kinds of reactions that people have been venting to this ending have ranged from sort of sweetly naive to rageaholism of its worst, most gamerific form. So many game reviews come down to, is this worth your money? And I can't think of any other form of entertainment, you know. The New York Times Book Review doesn't ask whether or not the book's worth their money.
But wait a minute. All petulance about the money aside, what is it about this game that prompted so much ire? Is it because they were denied the opportunity to truly affect their own ending at the end of the game? Everybody had the same experience. The only thing your choices could change was the color of the explosion. It's a betrayal of what the game experience was promising all along.
If BioWare does redo the ending, it's never going to satisfy anyone because the ending will never be experienced in the optimal psychological space. Trying to go back to that moment right before you were disappointed and re-empty yourself of all your prior knowledge of everything that's led you here, I just don't think anyone's going to be happy with whatever they do. These poor writers at BioWare have had to keep track of dozens upon dozens of choices that you can make, and the branching pathways become more extreme with each game. Trying to ask, you know, a game to deliver a satisfying ending when it's literally keeping track of hundreds of possible permutations of an ending, I mean, I think it's probably impossible.
Well, give me an example of a video game with a really great ending.
I would say Red Dead Redemption as one of the best endings of, I think, any game ever made.
And this is a game sort of like Grand Theft Auto. You have this world you can wander through, and there's a story you can follow if you want, right?
Yeah. So Red Dead Redemption is the story of a guy named John Marston who's trying to fight to save his family, and he's shot dead at the end by a posse. So after John Marston dies, you're kind of startled and you think, well, that's the end of the game. But suddenly the card comes up 3 years later and you're John Marston's son kneeling next to your father's grave. And then what you don't know as the player is that you can sort of wander around, and if you walk into a certain town, someone will approach you and give you information. And you can actually go down, find your father's killer, and find him fishing down by a river. You ask him if he remembers your father. He says yes. And then you cold-bloodedly murder him, and then the title, Red Dead Redemption, the end, comes up and this great music plays, and that's the end of the game. And it's a wonderfully bloodthirsty, vengeance-minded end of, you know, what is a really violent, bloody game. And I love, it has no moral patness, it's really complicated, you don't necessarily feel like you did the right thing. But it placed this ending out in this world for you to find.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. It was great.
Tom Bissell writes for Grantland. He has a new book coming out about the creative process called Magic Hours. That game with the great ending, Red Dead Redemption, features protagonist John Marston, rugged survivalist, former outlaw.
I rode in a gang.
Marston's story is studded with ambushes, ride-by shootings, and public executions. He's been given the task of fighting to tame the Wild West. The main protagonist of Call of Duty, Black Ops, Alex Mason, also knows that not all missions can be accomplished within legal bounds. Game designers Anna Anthropy, Sebastian Janisch, and Michael Molinari are all too familiar with that kind of digital narrative, but in creating their own video games, they choose to tell very different stories, more like memoir or diary. Anna, Sebastian, Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I'd like you each to begin by describing one of your games. Anna, let's begin with you. What is Dysphoria about?
It's about the past 6 months of my life. I decided to go on hormone replacement therapy. I'm a trans woman. I made the game to try and communicate all of the frustration of the experience of dealing with the medical industry, dealing with society, with my own gender dysphoria, and also the hope that comes out of it after struggling up what is basically a mountain.
In a sense, to mark your own route. Describe the four levels.
So the first level is about making the decision to go on hormones, which was a big, long, arduous process for me. Having to deal with feeling like you don't belong in the woman's bathroom, with getting misgendered by people on the street. The second level is about the process of actually dealing with the medical industry, finding a clinic, dealing with testing. I had to get my blood pressure under control before they would even let me get on hormones. The third level is about actually being on hormones, dealing with wild mood swings, being unable to have my girlfriend touch me because parts of my body were really sensitive and dysphoric. The fourth level was kind of about getting through all that and reaching a place where I kind of was a lot more comfortable than when I started. When I started making the game, I was basically in level 3 of the game myself, and I didn't know then how the game would end and whether, you know, it would in fact be a happy ending.
Michael, tell me about your games. You have one called That Was Yesterday.
Yes, it was created during a time when I was kind of transitioning. I mean, I came from a little tourist beach town in New Jersey, and I moved all the way out to San Francisco area to get my first full-time job making video games. And that's really cool, but I was by myself. I left all my family, my friends. I explained in my head what was going on, and then I almost literally translated these things, saying there's a wall that you need to face away from, and in order to get through the wall, instead of bumping your head against it, you need to look to the past and find all the things that kind of help you drive forward.
I have to tell you, I tried to play the game. I got through the first wall, and then I was in the snow area, and then I couldn't get past the wall after beating my head against the wall in the game a few dozen times.
When you face away from this wall, which kind of represents problems and fears and whatever you think it might be, this big, dense wall, it kind of recedes and it moves back. The key there is to exercise patience and wait for the wall to disappear. And once it's off the screen, then you're able to turn around, face forward, and start moving through life a little bit further. By the end of the game, you find out that even though you are physically alone, you're not alone spiritually, because you bring with you all of the experiences with all the people that you've been with in the past. And so they kind of help you get where you need to go.
Sebastian, your game was about depression. And this was the game, I think, that for me most fulfilled the goal, if that was your goal, to summon up what it feels like to be depressed. There's, again, the metaphor of beating your head against the wall. The second you get through to another place, the same arduous process of beating your head against the wall begins again, or beating your head against various objects and little very minor spatters of blood, lest you forget that this is actually painful. And the whole thing feels very lonely.
Thank you. Yeah, that really sounds a lot like what I would have hoped someone would kind of get out of the game.
You picture your own death. Or did I just... Spoiler alert!
That is... Well, I kind of intended for it to represent a sort of inner death, the game ending. I started making it just to kind of almost relieve myself because I was feeling all this emotion, or more like a lack of emotion. You know, I thought maybe making this game would make me feel better. Essentially, what I wanted to try and do was make it so that when you play it, because of the way the gameplay is designed, you'll start to feel how I felt.
Is it because the three of you work in the business that to convey these acutely personal moments, you turned to games rather than poetry?
This is Anna. Games are particularly well-suited for exploring dynamics and systems because they're about rules. My experience with hormone therapy was characterized by frustration. And, you know, what better form in which to make an audience feel frustration? Like, people play video games, they complain, they say, you know, this is so frustrating. This part of the level is just so badly designed. It really is one of the best suited forms to actually having your audience experience the frustration that you're feeling, because you can set up goals, you can rig the variables, so it's very hard to meet those goals.
This is Sebastian. If I'm watching a movie, I'm watching somebody else's story. But in a video game, even in something as simple as Tetris, it's your story. You're providing the input.
If nobody played your games, would it still be incredibly satisfying to have made them?
Actually, with Lackadaisium, I wasn't even sure if I was going to release it or not. I did sort of make it for myself. I thought it was maybe a little presumptuous of me to assume that other people would be interested in my experiences. But I just kind of figured I had already kind of made this thing, and maybe some other people would find some value in it.
Anna?
I wanted my game to sort of reach out to other trans people who were going through sort of the same experience, and to kind of carry the message that maybe it gets better. I have heard from so many people that, like, it really resonated with them and they felt that way.
Michael, what's the reaction been to "That Was Yesterday"?
Some people had more personal experiences than I even had when I was making it, because I was fusing my own experiences to make these hybrid semi-autobiographical moments in the game, and people actually had them. And so they would thank me and just let me know that I helped them deal with whatever was going on in their life that was similar to what was going on in the game.
Anna, you offer tools in your book for amateurs to create their own form of expression through games.
The game industry has become so conservative, more like Hollywood, and I think that, you know, amateurs, as you put it, making their own games and making smaller games that are more personal, more maybe like, you know, the games that we're talking about today, is really important to video games as an art form. And I think it is also just as inevitable as it is necessary.
Well, thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you.
Sebastian and Michael, thank you too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Sebastian Janisch and Michael Molinari are independent game designers. Game designer Anna Anthropy's first book, The Rise of the Video Game Zinesters, How Freaks, Normals, Amateurs, Artists, Dreamers, Dropouts, Queers, Housewives, and People Like You Are Taking Back an Art Form, was published this month. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Robert Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.